Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Left Turn Canada. I'm Andy, this is Christo, and we're excited to talk once again about leftist issues that affect all of us Canadians. And we're going to start off by something that I think is perhaps not a uniquely Canadian thing, but seems to be an enjoyable pastime, is just absolutely hating our local telecoms. I think that is something that is universal and brings us all together. And I think it's one of the great Canadian pastimes, is despising everything about the people that bring you your internet and your phone. Christo, do you share in this absolute hate of this technological apparatus?
Yeah, I mean, if I could be diplomatic, I would just like to say that all the telcos should go to hell. But no, this really is, I think, something that unites a lot of people. I know that if you ever look up those like worst companies of the year in the United States, often companies like Verizon and these sorts of big telcos down there are near the top of the list, often with Electronic Arts or Blizzard or Activision.
Yeah, you know what I mean? it's funny how video game companies get in there. Yeah.
But like in Canada, you know, we got a particular situation where, you know, we pay a lot for our internet and our phone service and our speeds are slower. And so relative to a lot of other developed nations, we pretty much get the screws more than anyone else. And so this is really an issue that sort of unites Canadians, is that they hate telcos. And the question, and we could talk about it today, is, well, what do you do about it?
Yeah. And I think just to hammer that point a lot, because of the great monopoly of telecoms here in Canada, where I believe they're referred to as the big three, and now, you know, the big two is now getting that much bigger after eating the fourth on the list. Basically, they're allowed to throttle and take advantage of a lot of communities that are not major big cities like Toronto, and just essentially not provide, in many cases, adequate services. I don't know if you've seen stories like this, but because of how the telcos work in major cities, there's always a fee for the rental of whatever the unit is if you're dealing with internet, because the actual boxes are so expensive that a regular person normally is not going to spend, you know, $300 on a box they can just rent for, you know, a couple of bucks. But there's so many horror stories of people returning them and something getting lost in the shuffle, and regular consumers having to pay hundreds, thousands of dollars because there was one little mistake, and being chased down for years, affecting major credit by this massive organization that follows you all around the country. And it really does make a lot of people want to turn to something smaller. And then we found out this week, even those groups that may be a little bit smaller and offering something that is a bit of an alternative ultimately seem to get swallowed up by the big three.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, if you look at it, I mean, we really do have an issue here where, like, much like in the US and other countries, like, there's technically, it's not a monopoly technically, but you have all these sorts of places where there might only be one or maybe two viable options, and they can effectively price collude even if they're not legally price colluding. And it creates a scenario where what is now more than ever a basic human necessity, like internet, really is just as important as basic phone service and really it's a utility now. Like it's a goddamn utility, right? It's right up there with like heat and water. It's like you might not need it to physically survive as a Homo sapien, but you need it to be like a human being increasingly.
Especially like how COVID has made so much work, if you are fortunate enough to be able to work from home and through the internet, not having access to that as a public utility becomes as essential as electricity, because that is, for many people, their only means to make a living while still being safe.
Yeah. I mean, like, look, and we've seen the consequences, right? Like, the fact of the matter is, like, you have students here in Ontario, and not even in far-flung Ontario. We're not just talking about the isolated north, but in small towns, they don't have the bandwidth to do school. Like, there's kids that can't do their homework, can't do their assignments during COVID because, you know, this they don't have the internet at home. Either they physically don't have enough bandwidth or it's too expensive because of the data caps. And so you have families having to, like, go out to, like, their relative and sit in the car or something, or, like, go to the public library just to download something that's 45 minutes away because we don't have reliable internet service for many Canadians. It's not even just about income. I mean, income's a part of it, but it's like, if you live in, like, certain parts of rural Ontario where, you know, we're Andy and I are both from Ontario, you know, you just don't have good internet. It's just, it's not a thing. Even if you have the money, you just don't have it. And if you need to do your homework or apply for a job or work remotely or any of that, or even if you're, like, a small business, it's like, you just don't have good internet.
Mm-hmm. And I think the reason we're talking about this, in case, again, we buried the lead a little bit, is the massive merger between Rogers Communication and Shaw Communication that was finally approved. They've reached an agreement, Rogers to acquire Shaw, in a deal valued at $26 billion, the deal combining Canada's two very large cable companies and, of course, their wireless networks. I believe Rogers in the ranking was number two. And like I said before, I think Shaw was number four. So it's not as if they're picking up, you know, Wind Mobile or something a little small, tech savvy, something on the side. Yeah. It's a major, major institution that I believe covers different regions as well. Like, regionally, I believe Shaw has a lot of market share in certain places. So this effectively gives Rogers a lot more access to more of the country. And people that are proponents of this, very strong-willed, you know, iron capitalists, are saying this will create more opportunity for the service to provide you better service. I don't know if there's anyone that actually believes that. Like, I think there's that much antipathy towards telecoms that I don't think it's something that is really being sold. I don't know who could possibly be excited about this merger from a consumer basis.
Well, one thing we should say is that technically the deal hasn't fully gone through yet because it needs to go through the Competition Bureau. Canada has a largely insignificant, meaningless, do-nothing Competition Bureau that's supposed to exist to analyze deals like this and then ask, will it hurt, you know, competition? Will it hurt consumers in the country? Will it hurt other businesses? If the answer is yes, they might not allow the deal to go through, or they might only allow the deal to go through with certain stipulations. Now, I don't think anyone really expects them to block the deal. So it's not done yet, but it's people see the Bureau as a rubber stamp. And I mean, my perspective is, like, I think you're right. I think a lot of people intuitively understand that the existing problem with the private model is that you have too few companies with too much power, and all this deal is going to do is make fewer companies with more power distributed between those fewer companies. So if anything, it's going to exacerbate the problem. It's not going to solve it in any meaningful way. At least that's my perspective. Now, I think what the left has to do is assert its own vision here. And this is, I think, where we need to do better, because I have a piece coming out with Passage, you know, a left-wing publication here in Canada. It's great. It's new. Go check it out. Where I'm arguing that we need to promote this as an opportunity for public ownership of telecommunications, and how the left in Canada, at least the left represented by the NDP, has really failed to kind of seize that opportunity, because the discourse has been from really all the parties in different ways is we need to ensure that there's regulations and that there's competition.
Yeah. And just to interject there, the comment that we got from NDP leader Jagmeet Singh, was that this merger will only help big telecom companies profit more on the backs of Canadians. But there's still that implicit understanding that they have a role and don't need to go through this fundamental change. The odd thing, too, is to hear from some dyed-in-the-wool conservatives, like that Poilievre guy that they just despise.
Yeah, Poilievre, yeah.
Poilievre,
yeah,
excuse me, yeah. All the French listeners. Mentioning that this amalgamation, this new monopoly, will provide more of a competitive basis and help, you know, the basics of his capitalist view. But it's funny to see even the extremes of our major parties. We don't have a view here that strays from the established order, it seems.
Well, at least not yet. I mean, I've spoken to some people in the NDP that perhaps there's something being worked on. But as of now, as this story is brewing, I mean, in general, you're right. I mean, I think what Singh is saying is the Competition Bureau should block the merger. So Singh has a different opinion here. But again, I mean, one of the challenges is you look to a party of the left and you say, what's being offered here? Like, what are we trying to do here? Like, what are we trying to offer as an alternative? And in essence, there's not really anything being offered here. I mean, what Singh is effectively saying is we need price caps and we need like a consumer bill of rights. But the issue is fundamentally that like you have this human necessity being provided for profit, right? Like that's the issue here. And so, you know, you have a human necessity being provided for profit, which means that people can profit off something that everyone needs. And even unlike food, which isn't a monopoly in Canada, we could talk about grocery conglomeration, but there's not a monopoly like there is with telcos, right? You know, there's only like three or four companies you can go to. You can't just go to the local fruit stand and buy your internet, right?
Like
you
just, yeah, listen. Like three, yeah. They did not need Pete Buttigieg to come in and do price fixing for telecoms because of the already established way that telecoms already are able to do that. It's not needed because they've already won in that way. And I think I want to reiterate what you said there. The idea that there are people so act that there's a business that is meant to profit over something that is so fundamental and essential to what it means to be a Canadian isn't being talked about enough when discussing these issues. Like we said, we're talking a lot about how we can fix small things, but making fundamental changes, I think, will always be a position, and offering those changes will always be a position that leftists in Canada can find themselves. Because in a lot of these cases, when hearing what other political parties are saying, that doesn't seem to be the language that's always being used. It's about tweaking the system, making small changes, maybe, but this is something that, you know, will help people. So let's start right from the bat. What does it mean, Christo, to nationalize telecoms?
Well, I mean, in general, you already have some examples of it. In some provinces, they have like SaskTel, and they have some of these public corporations. And it could exist in two ways. One, you could form a true public monopoly, which is to say that the federal government can do it because telecommunications is federal in jurisdiction, unambiguously, because it's designed to cross provincial and national borders. You could create like the Canadian Telecommunications Corporation, right? You could do that, right? Or you could create a new one either by purchasing outright an existing private corporation and operating it within the market sort of as a public alternative, which is what exists in some provinces where they have, you know, a public auto company, but it doesn't necessarily have a monopoly and you know, other private insurance can exist. And so those are the two general models. The reason I think it's necessary is, again, the tweaks aren't working. I mean, again, going back to what the NDP ran on in 2019, they said, you know, we want to put price caps on like telecommunications bills. And they talked about it saving $10 a month per like phone, basically. So if you had like, you would save about $120 a year. They said for a family of two, you would save about, $250 a year. Like, that's one, that's not a lot of money. And two, as we've noted, like, price is a factor here, but so are broader things like access and equitability. And that can't be fixed by saving people $10 a month, right? So one of the challenges here, as we noted, is that private corporations exist to make profit. They exist to make profit. They don't exist for any social necessity. They exist for profit. And so when you exist for profit, you do not exist to provide a service. And so when we're asking ourselves why, and there are more than one reason, but why do some small towns and some small communities in this country not have some of the basic necessities they need? And it's because the corporations do not find it profitable to provide those services, right? So if you operate a crown corporation, a public company, on the basis of providing internet to everyone on an affordable and equitable basis, you remove that profit motive as part of the consideration. Now, there might still be technological considerations. I'm not a, you know, an expert on the engineering side of internet. I don't know even if with a public corporation you could provide truly high-speed internet to isolated communities in the territories. I'm not sure. But I damn well know we could do better. And I damn well know one of the reasons is because the profit motive sort of chokes out social necessity. It's the reason why, like, all of these small towns lost their bus service in Saskatchewan when they privatized the bus company, right? When they privatized the Saskatchewan, inter-community transit service, right? It wasn't profitable, and a private corporation won't, unless they're forced, maybe yeah. They're given some sort of monopoly, to run unprofitable routes.
Now, does this method address, because I think that is what you're touching on there, but I think one of the chief concerns that people do have with their telecoms, if they're able to get access, which is not always guaranteed, if they're able to afford it, which is not always guaranteed, but just the unfortunate bureaucracy that is associated with operating any sort of telecom seems to be impenetrable for, you know, people of a certain age, for people of a certain access. It is an unbelievably difficult process many times to get the service you need in the way that you need it, unless you are intimately involved and aware of the details of internet and phone service, which, you know, I don't, ideally that would be something that most Canadians wouldn't have to do because we have this service provided. Do you think that change in ideology from a corporate driven mode to a service driven mode, where that is essentially the bottom line, it's not about making a profit, you have to provide a service because it is essential, do you think that necessarily would address this issue? Because I'm not 100% convinced that it would change that problem completely.
Look, for being honest, probably not all the way. I mean, look, bureaucracy is an issue, whether it's a private sector bureaucracy or a public sector bureaucracy. And just, you know, if we're envisioning a radically different society where we really are fundamentally transforming things, because, you know, this as much as it is an element of what you might expect in a democratic socialist society, you can have a fully nationalized telco system in a capitalist society, right? Like, we're not tearing down capitalism here. We're decommodifying a certain service. So the reality probably is much like how there remains bureaucracy within the Canadian healthcare system, even if it is run as a single payer system, they're likely going to still be bureaucratic issues. But I you have to think that it's not as if there's none now. You know,
yeah, so that's interesting too. Like, one of the chief concerns is, you know, always with anything that's remotely anti-capitalist, that isn't entirely capitalist, is you're going to die in bureaucracy. And this is, you know, a mega monopoly behemoth, and it has some of the worst bureaucratic issues that I've had to personally face as a Canadian. So, you know, like you said before, it's very unlikely that it would get worse, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's my view. And I mean, look, we could talk to American friends who will very much tell you that just because their healthcare system is private, it is not devoid of bureaucracy. And in fact, you know, healthcare insurance, which we have here in Canada, can also be incredibly bureaucratic, just as much, if not more so, than the public system that runs alongside it. So it's not as if your dental care insurance access is bureaucracy-free and you're, you know, going to the doctor for a prescription is bureaucracy-laden. So, I mean, I'm not too concerned about that. I think, like, again, the opportunity here is to provide a service that people need. I mean, look, I mean, when Jagmeet Singh did an event in 2018, and this is something I reference in my upcoming article, he made it clear that we need to see the internet as a fundamental human right. It's accessing high-speed internet is a human right now. Like, people sometimes scoff when I say that, especially maybe a bit of older folks, not to typecast, but they grew up at a time where internet wasn't essential. It didn't exist. And then it was this weird little thing, right? You know, but it is a human right. And so we need to ensure that it's available to everyone, right? Like, that's like, we need to do that. And the only way that's going to happen is through public ownership. Like, that's the only way it's going to happen. There's no tweaking our way out of this one. There's no tweaking our way out of this one. Like, this is an example, and not the only one, of how capitalism has failed to supply the demand that's there. Like, if you talk about fundamentally, like, capitalism, one of the extolling virtues of capitalism is that it can supply the demand. It can meet supply and demand.
The market will save all. You know,
if you take economics in university, they'll draw the XY axis graph, point to a line and say, that's why poor people deserve to starve. but the argument is in this mathematic theoretical elegance that capitalism, hypothetically, even though such conditions don't exist, in perfect competitive conditions, the market will always meet the demand. It'll always meet it. There will be some place where there is a supply and a demand that will meet. But what we see with this is that clearly Canadians want and need reliable, affordable, high-speed internet, and, like, it's not being supplied. It's not being supplied to many Canadians that don't get what they need. And this really is, I think, an issue that has some political salience. And I mean, I think that we talked a bit about it, and I mean, I wrote about it recently, how the NDP has this real compulsion to just flagellate itself to small businesses and be like, we love small businesses. Like, please,
the heart and soul of Canadians. They're not like those big bad businesses where you can't see the boss. You know, if there's a boss that makes $100,000 and you make $12 an hour and there's only 20 employees, then that's okay. But if there's 200 employees, he's up by his bootstraps. He took a chance, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So
you got to get rid of that.
Yeah. No, 100%. But if you are being practical about it, you could reasonably make the case that this, and I wrote about this, this is one of those issues that, like, as a left-wing party, you could build some basis of support. Because I guarantee you, so many small businesses are just getting absolutely shellacked by internet companies. Absolutely. And not just internet, but their phone service, their cell phone services.
Well, and data, also data coverage too. Like, it's not even what we commercially, or rather personally, need to have for our own homes. But the cost of transferring data in the values that major businesses need based on regions, like versus Toronto versus Guelph, different areas like that, the rates can be astronomically different. Looking into it a little bit for some, you know, small businesses, ironically, that I'm familiar with, that it really is kind of a crapshoot. So having some regulation in that way, I think, could be, like you said, a real big win. Now, what do you say to the other criticism? I think that's a little bit more from the right of our current plan, saying that the issues that we have in the telecom sector are because there's monopolies. So if we're just able to break it up and we can have a lot of smaller businesses, medium-sized businesses that are really fighting in that beautiful cage of capitalism, then, like I said before, a horrible human once said to me, the cream will rise to the top. I have heard that as a criticism of our current system, you know, from a left-wing perspective, why will that not solve our problem?
Well, I mean, my argument would be, I mean, I'm sure they would disagree with it, but I mean, there's a few reasons. One, telecommunications, especially in like the broadest sense, you might have some small, very boutique companies that offer last mile services or what have you. But like the fact of the matter is it's an industry based on scale. We're not talking about ice cream parlors here. We're talking about like massive global, national, regional, like systems of telecommunications with billions of dollars of infrastructure. It's like there are certain industries that trend towards oligopoly. Like you can through certain policies encourage less oligopoly in certain industries, but I would say that this is one of those industries that I think is inevitably oligopolistic. And even if you encourage competition, there's no guarantee that the companies that succeed in that initial scrimmage will not just use their initial success to snowball themselves back into monopolies again or oligopolies again, right? And so I'm not convinced. I mean, I'm sure that in some of the issues might be addressed by that, and maybe in some urban centers you might see lower prices, but I don't think that will solve the issue of access, and I don't think that'll solve the issue of equitability. And maybe a hardcore capitalist will say that that's not the intention. The intention is to provide profit and services that have a supply and demand within the profit motive.
That's a hard sell right now, I feel like, on the conservative side. I feel like there's, like we said at the beginning, there's such an established hatred of dealing with these firms, you know, around North America and around the world. I think it's a really tough position to say that the only place that telecoms have in our current system is to provide profit. Like, even that has been something.
Oh, capital will never say that, right?
Yes.
Like, you know, and I mean, don't forget the conservatives. I believe it was the conservatives. One of their approaches was to lean into consumer politics. If they didn't create the consumer, the merger bureau, the competition bureau, I think they really touted it, because that was one of their arguments. We don't need socialism. We need competition. That's the argument. And this is, again, where as an NDPer and as a democratic socialist, I'm frustrated because, yeah, I understand why this should be blocked in the short term. But then the solution really should be not to just have more competition. The solution with social necessities is public ownership. We would never say on the left in Canada, at least I hope to God we wouldn't, that the issue with the healthcare system is there's no competition, right? The issue is we don't fund it enough. Like, there are tons of issues with our healthcare system. Competition isn't the issue, right?
Yeah, so the mechanism to stop this is already the wrong one, even if it is doing something that might be good and effective and help Canadians and, you know, reinforce a change that we want. They're using it under the basis, absolutely, of that this would hurt competition. And I think you said it pretty clearly there. This is not an industry, like, this should stop the conversation. This is not an industry that works like ice cream stands. You can't have all of these very, very small boutique internet service providers. The cost of the technology just isn't there. So it has to be maintained through a push for capital. And why not have this essential service that requires such a capital investment, that requires such a reach into different jurisdictions across our country? Why not have that be something that's seen as just as essential as electricity or other services? Like, I don't know if this would be something that politically, if it was, you know, introduce a big push by the NDP, that would be unsuccessful. Where do you see the route to success for this sort of idea? Probably you think an NDP, or do you think the Libs could ever, you know, stomach this type of idea?
I don't think the Liberals, at least in this era, would do this. I think the Liberals back in an earlier time period, especially in a minority government, might do it. I mean, don't forget that it was under Pearson's Liberal minority that a lot of Social services were created. Pierre Trudeau did experiment with limited forms of nationalization. So, you know, liberal governments in the past, usually under NDP pressure, but not always, did experiment with certain forms of nationalization. But, you know, Trudeau is more interested in things like public-private partnerships. I think if you're going to see this, at the federal level at least, it's going to come through the NDP. And that's why I think a lot of people were very disappointed when Singh correctly called out the merger deal, but then offered no coherent vision for an alternative. Because the alternative is not a quote-unquote consumer bill of rights. The alternative must be public ownership. Again, like, if we want to build a truly equitable, innovative society, then the internet is essential. And so I think the argument has to be, and look, is this going to be the thing that makes or breaks a campaign? Probably not. But the NDP needs to run on nationalization of at least one of the big three. Maybe, you know, you will buy out one of the big three corporations and you will run it as a national telecommunications corporation with the goal of providing as a basic right internet service. And you couch it as social justice. You couch it as you're fighting racism, because a lot of rural communities, especially indigenous communities, are often disadvantaged, and this is one of the reasons. You couch it as helping small businesses. You can couch it in so many ways. This truly is one of those, like, web policies. And pun not intended, but, like, it's a web policy in that it's a policy that connects to economic, cultural, racial, you know, all these forms of justice and injustice that I think need to happen.
Right? And just to add to that, even if, you know, you're a regular consumer, that unfortunately a lot of that, not regular consumer, but perhaps you're an individual where those issues aren't immediately affecting your life. So unfortunately, when they're being touted by a political party, they're not as persuasive. Ultimately, this change will, based on a lot of the evidence and research, lower costs for the average consumer and provide more access. It would provide free access in many cases for, you know, seniors, different luxury services that people really like Crave and things like that, depending on the purchase. You know, the HBO greatness would be provided freely to Canadians with this ownership idea. I think that it really does seem like it would be a big win for both the more socially conscious Canadians and someone that just can't stand that this bill is the way that it is, you know, every month. It's interesting for me because I'm not as connected into the Canadian political discourse as much as you are, Christo, and being more connected and seeing what that discourse is, for me, it can be very disappointing and discouraging, because we talked about this last week when trying to push the NDP into a party that will reflect some of these value changes that we think would benefit Canadians, and the importance of coming together around a party, even if the established ideology isn't perfect, but trying to work together, not trying to destroy someone who is perhaps a few degrees different, but is so close in fundamental ideology to what you believe, you know, seeing how these ideas are communicated online, at least, there seems to be a lot of discourse that is fighting against that. That it's about, you know, what degree of socialist you are, what degree of communist you are, versus how to actually make meaningful changes for the communities that we're a part of. I wonder what you're thinking about that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's an unreasonable point. I mean, I think some of that is based on a legitimate concern that people that claim the mantle of leftism don't want to do the work and have the values essential to it. And I mean, look, we see this kind of everywhere where everyone wants to be seen. All these centrists want to be seen as on the left, but they don't actually have the values because they know that the like being like left wing is objectively correct and popular, and they want that branding. So I understand that. And I mean, I've done that too. But I agree that it, more productive than simply saying like, how socialist are you? These sorts of things is what policies can left-wing parties and movements and organizations offer that sort of unite the broad left? And honestly, not to beat a dead horse, not to beat a dead telco, that this is one of them. Because I really think this is the kind of policy that I see a lot of people to the left of the NDP saying, why isn't the NDP pushing for the nationalization of telcos? And I see a lot of very dedicated NDPers who are not necessarily on the left fringe of the party saying, this is the way to do it. Like, public ownership could unite, like, broad swaths of the party on an issue they could all get together on. And that's important. When you unite people around issues and you unite people around an immediate fight, you build solidarity. It's no surprise that in the States, various types of leftists stopped fighting with one another, largely, during the Bernie primary. Because Bernie was uniting people with a clear message, Medicare for all, Green New Deal. There are other things, but basically, Medicare for all, Green New Deal, workers' rights, like mm-hmm. that, you know, and like racial
the Medicare
justice.
For all in particular was something yeah. that it was enough. It was close yeah. enough to a reality for a lot of people yeah. that I think never perceived that it could be that exactly what you said happened, where there
and
was.
So,
a, yeah.
yeah,
go ahead.
And so Singh, if the NDP and look, like I get I defend the NDP more than a lot of people on the left. I'm like, I'm a party member, all of these things. But like, look, if they want unity, if they want like everyone to sort of like circle the wagons and get ready for an election fight, offer people policies like this so that people on the left can say, look, party's not perfect, but my goodness, look at these two or three things that I really believe in. So if Singh is like, look, we're not going to build socialism in 2021, but we're going to nationalize a telco, we're going to tax the rich, we're going to get everyone pharmacare, and like just four or five good things will win a lot of people over. And like, this is a low-hanging fruit. Like, nationalize the goddamn telcos. You know what I mean? Like,
no, yeah, no, I feel it. Yeah. My concern is I don't know for what we've seen if Jagmeet is the individual that will be willing to do that. So my question yeah. is, even if, you know, that doesn't happen, what you said, which I think would be really essential for bringing a lot of these stronger-willed leftists into the fold of the NDP, would you still recommend and advocate for, how would I put this, for the positive success of the NDP, even if this doesn't happen? You know, how do we, if that doesn't happen, because it would be great, it'd be wonderful, and I agree that it would bring a lot of people together. What do you say now to more strong-willed leftists who are feeling not represented and not cared for by the NDP because these changes perhaps haven't been said and haven't been expressed? Because personally, I still think there is value in trying to come together and not immediately throw any criticism on any sort of representation from the NDP that isn't exactly what you want. We talked about it before. They get hit, called socialists by mainstream media for doing this, and called not progressive enough by pretty much everyone else because of the choices they're making. So I'm interested to see where your mind lands on this one.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, I don't think, you know, I would necessarily throw the party out with the bathwater on this one issue. For example, in the last election, they made this mistake, I think, but the party ran on pharmacare. They ran on something of a dental care program, which wasn't sufficient, but would have gotten 6 million Canadians dental care, so, you know, that they wouldn't otherwise have. But this was one of the issues, along with things like a refusal to cancel student loan debt and really lean into a universal post-secondary education. Now, when you're talking about politics, you have to ask yourselves and balance these issues, values, pragmatism, alternatives, And it's not as if any other party that will contest even a fraction of the seats in this country is offering that policy. So I don't know if that would be the only one. But I definitely think, and again, I've spoken with some people in the party, that this may be something that's being worked on, that the that public ownership in this industry and public ownership more broadly needs to be pushed. I mean, look, one thing you can credit with Jugmeet is one of the shadow portfolios he created was focusing on public services and public ownership. And I think that that's crucial. Now, this isn't the only question. I mean, I think that the NDP needs to lean harder into postal banking. I think that the lack, we saw it when a lot of bus services in the West, and specifically in Saskatchewan, were shut down, were basically privatized and shut down. The fact of the matter is that here in Canada, we need a national bus service. There's no reason why Via Rail, which did it in the past, couldn't have integrated bus service to communities along the Via Rail lines to act as a filter system, because it might not be feasible to build train tracks every which way, but it would be feasible to send buses out in a radius from where the trains currently go and where we might add new trains. You know, these are all things that the party needs to lean into. Again, I don't know if they will, but the fact of the matter is that, you know, capitalism has failed. And Singh has done a lot right. He was right in noting back during the early stages of the pandemic where Justin Trudeau and a lot of like the mainstream media was saying, you know, when we get back to normal, we have to be patient and care for one another until we get back to normal. And Singh said normal didn't work for Canadians. Normal didn't work for the poor. It didn't work for the working class. It didn't work for Indigenous people. It didn't work for Black people and other minorities. It doesn't work, right? And so we have to ask ourselves, when we say normal wasn't working, there's a lot of things there. It's not just purely economic, but like the private ownership of our essential industries does not work for Canadians. And the NDP needs to offer that as an alternative. They're the only party that that has, you know, electability and even the infrastructure to contest the 338 seats that can offer that. So it's not even a question of would you support them if not. The question is, like, they can be the only ones. Will they step up and do it?
Well, it's funny when you bring up the comments that were made by Jagmeet when this began, because it just it brings me to the other perhaps misstep that he made a little after that, talking about, you know, how a worker, a small business worker wants to get back to work and the importance of that, and just how that one little misstep that wasn't exactly in line with the values of some leftists was fodder for ridicule, and he was completely just seen as like a horrible leader because of that. And it just, I don't know, I do feel like there is, and this is kind of what I've been dancing around the last little while, there seems to be a lack of solidarity unless it is under the exact guidelines that some individuals seem fit. And me personally, I don't think that's how you build solidarity. And I think that you're right. If we can just move the needle a little bit, you know, get Jagmeet to drop the super rich off of the super rich tax, you know, try to get the telecom ownership, like just a few of those big ticket items, it could be seen as a huge wind of change, because Canadians right now are hurting more than ever. And it's what we're going to talk about soon. It doesn't really seem like we will be returning to that quote unquote back to normal thanks to vaccinations either, because of the mistakes that are being made and because of some of the infrastructure problems and size problems that we have here in Canada. By the time every Canadian is fully vaccinated, I don't think our economy, our way of living before that will work. So even if Jagmeet and the NDP don't push to the level that we perhaps would like, I do think there is some value in trying to find solidarity under that platform than throwing the party out with the bathwater, like you said.
Yep. I mean, like, look, I remember that tweet. It was the rhetoric was bad. Like, there's a balance. I do think that, however, Like, a lot of times...
It does seem a little performative, a little bit, yeah, you know? Like, it does... I don't know.
It is, but it's also, like, it's Twitter drama, right? And, yeah, like, even within the party, everyone forgot about that in, like, 2 days, right? Yeah. But, like, you're right, though. You're right.
I think I'm just getting old, man. I think that's...
Yeah.
Like, it's just, I don't have the ability to follow all of... It's almost like gossip. It's strange how much of political discourse, quote-unquote, just translates to me... As someone that doesn't think poor people should die and we should have basic fundamental rights, as just like petty gossip. So I don't know if you've felt that at all, because you're really connected. You have your pulse on Canada and you got to follow, you know, every time Joe Biden trips down the stairs sort of thing, right?
Yeah, in America.
With your YouTube. Yeah. So like where do you think that goes into this entire conversation? Because a part of me kind of feels like it hurts trying to find solidarity when we're so focused on the minutiae. But then on the other hand, like, we are so starved for anything when it comes to content that can build, because the systems are so against us. People that, you know, believe that there should be equanimity for fucking humanity.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think some of it's performative, but I think a lot of it's legitimate frustration. I mean, I have much more to say there, right? I feel like some people need to be a little bit more good faith with left parties, but then left parties have to be actually responsive to their base. I mean, look, it's a perfectly legitimate criticism to say, as we noted, Jugmeet in 2018, you said that you saw the internet as a fundamental human right. And, like, you know, data caps, removing data caps and saving people $10 a month on their bill is great and all and nice, and we should do that. But, like, it's not going to solve the issue. Like, that's not providing a human right. That's very much like, you know, in American context, you know, making healthcare more affordable. It might be better, but it's not recognizing it as a human right yet, right? So I honestly, not to fence it, I sort of see both sides, and on an issue by issue basis, sometimes I find myself on one and one on the other. I think that when it comes to certain things, I'm like, that people are making too big of a deal out of this. But with this, I think, you know, this is an important opportunity, and it's one where the NDP can distinctify itself from the other parties. And implement something that will speak to the left and to the labor base and to the party meet. And I think that it's a no-brainer. Nationalize the telcos.
There we go. I'll leave it at that, because I think that's a good place to leave the conversation. No-brainer. Nationalize the telcos. Speaking of no-brainer, I don't know if you heard about this COVID thing, Christo. It's kind of a big deal.
Kind of a big deal, yeah.
Now, do you think you will be vaccinated in 2021? Both doses, as a healthy man that is not in his 60s or his 80s? Do you think you'll be getting it?
My instinct is that maybe.
Yeah.
I'm thinking like the fall. Like, look, okay, we shouldn't speculate here. Like, neither of us are public health officials. But, like, just to clarify, like, this is not based on any particular thing. But I don't expect to be vaccinated in the next few months. But I do expect probably to be vaccinated before Christmas. That's sort of what I'm thinking.
Okay.
And
I think that's important just to note, like, the hopefulness of certain Canadians, of average Canadians, for this process. Because if you compare that to, I think if this question was asked to an American, especially living in, you know, a bigger city, that answer would be very different, because we have seen how, rightly so, effective in many ways America has been at distributing this vaccine. You know, a month ago when we were first starting the show, it was one of the topics we wanted to discuss, because in one day, American authorities were able to distribute as many vaccinations that Canada had done, I think, in 3 months. And that number continues to grow. And now we're reaching such a fever pitch that 1.5 million vaccine doses are coming up from America in the next few months. And a lot of the initial trajectory of where we were supposed to be as a country when it comes to vaccinations are way off. And because of that, this is just recent, there's a belief in Ontario that we could see 500 patients per day in the ICU in Ontario within the first week of April. And that is the most individual patients in the ICU since this pandemic has happened. You know, the idea of this wave coming again and the need for a strong proponent of the population to be vaccinated so that they won't end up in hospitals and won't die. Not so they won't necessarily get sick if they initially have that first vaccination dose, is my understanding, but just to stop that throttling of our needed services in this province in Ontario didn't happen. And because of that, there's a real risk of what these next few months are going to look like. And I think a lot of that issue lands at the feet of the leaders of our province. I know in Nova Scotia, they're hoping to have everyone vaccinated in the province, both doses, by the end of June. Obviously, it's apples and oranges, but I think different areas have dealt with this better. What Doug Ford and the Conservatives have done here seems to be indicative of how I remember Doug Ford operating as a city councillor for years when I worked in Toronto at City Hall as a reporter. I don't understand when this happened, but there seemed to be an understanding that Toronto as a city had essential things that needed to change, or the city was going to fall apart. You know, if they didn't change transit, things were going to fall apart. If they didn't rebuild the Gardner Expressway, one of the two major highways that enter a city of millions, it will literally fall apart. But every major politician, whether it's a city councilor or the mayor, always fought against that idea because they don't want to be the representatives that caused in the Gardner Expressway's example, this major thoroughfare to be closed for 6 months. So it's just about putting it off and putting it off and putting it off until it's literally going to fall apart around us. And from what we've heard in a lot of the different articles covering the implementation of the vaccination rollout, Doug Ford and the Conservatives, you know, at one point, the Conservative czar, Rick Hillier, so if you haven't checked him out, he is just a horrible individual that had some anti-vax comments in the past. He was the chairman of it. And he believed publicly that they didn't need any sort of booking system when this began, that it was just as simple as going to the pharmacist and getting a shot. Originally, there was a belief that you needed at least 3 days of full training if you're going to administer vaccinations to understand what could possibly happen, to deal with any of the extenuating circumstances. As soon as the vaccination rollout here in Ontario, the reports that they only had 3 hours of actual training. Yeah. I'm going off on this, but I think it's indicative of how these politicians like this that have come from that Toronto sphere in particular are trying to implement these ideologies on the province, big macro ideas of just shifting the blame. And for something like public health, for saving our lives from a deadly disease that will allow our society to continue, I just feel like this is not the time to be playing politics locally.
No, I mean, look, I think fundamentally what we're seeing is like a just absolute failure here, whether it's on the vaccination side, whether it's on the failure to implement sick leave, whether it's on so many workers being put at risk. This province is failing, and it's not just this province, but as a whole, there's been a failure to continue to protect Canadians during this kind of final stretch. Like I know that we likely will wait longer for full vaccination or near full vaccination compared to the United States and some other advanced countries, but like the end of the tunnel is visible. Like we have some sort of timeline, and yet still people are being asked to effectively die on the altar of capital. I mean, I wrote a piece for Canadian Dimension where Amazon put the lives of thousands of workers at risk at one of their fulfillment centers, basically their shipping warehouses in Brampton, which is a working class, largely racialized community on kind of on the outskirts of Toronto.
Yeah, my hometown, actually. Yeah. So I just touching in on that quickly, just to cut it in, because one of the most obscene things about that story now, looking back, is that when the numbers in Brampton were high and the instances early on of the COVID virus in the populace seemed quite large for that city of that size, there was such absolute racist vitriol that it was because, you know, these were Indian and racial minority communities, and they didn't realize the rules, when now we know that a majority of that influx was not because, you know, people of a certain skin color just didn't understand the rules, but because people of a certain skin color, unfortunately, work jobs in that city that put them more at risk and were deliberately taken advantage of by a billion-dollar corporation that was able to do it for months at a time. And there was never a moment where that was the main headline on all of the papers. It was about what's wrong with Brampton, what's different in Brampton. It took months before something like this happened. And it's sickening. It's exactly what you said. It's people dying at the altar of capitalism and neoliberals waving their hands saying, you know, maybe racially we should accept that people of a different community act differently and that's why they're getting sick, instead of maybe looking at why we're in the middle of a COVID pandemic and you're able to get four TVs in 3 days. Like, maybe that's has something to do with people being at risk. And it's just absolutely sickening. It's my hometown. Really love Brampton. It's really sick that this happened. Please continue, Christo.
No, I mean, look, I mean, I don't know if I have much more to add than that, right? Like, we're like, this province is murdering people. And capital is murdering people. And I get it. Some of these workers are essential. But even when asked about it, Hillier and Ford, they were said, well, what are you going to consider putting some of these Amazon type workers without which the economy could not work right now? It couldn't probably work at all, but especially now, given that most of us are staying home more, that would they be prioritized for vaccines? And the answer was no. The answer was no. They would not be moved up. They would be vaccinated, you know, when those individuals would come up, given their age or health or what have you. And so the government has seen what happened at a place at Amazon, where hundreds of workers have gotten COVID throughout the crisis, but you know, about a third of them in the last couple of weeks alone, and are doing nothing to protect workers like them in very high density workplaces that again are essential. Right? They are essential workers.
Yeah, no, it's just, it's really unfortunate that, you know, this is the place that we're at, but not having that consideration for what an essential worker is. You know, we all remember early on in the pandemic that there were lauding in every corner, every sort of healthcare worker that admittedly put themselves at risk and tried to help people that were dying and sick. But it took a long time before that was extended to the person that you screamed at Sobeys because, you know, they said you couldn't put this many items on the conveyor belt due to safety restrictions. Just as essential, just as needed. And it's almost now that we're finally looking at, you know, maybe those Amazon items that we all needed in many cases to get through this pandemic, because many of the other stores weren't opened. There was a human cost to that. And I don't know if the check will ever come due when it comes to that cost, but it does really make me feel sick that so many people had to suffer for something that, I don't know, like, this has been talked about in other countries of how they dealt with it, but, like, why wasn't there a complete lockdown and, you know, the Canadian military came in to fill some of these roles and services? You know, why didn't we actually deal with this correctly early on, as opposed to these partitioned lockdowns, bit by bit, little by little, trying to see if we can keep certain economies afloat, because, you know, we can't possibly dream of shutting everything down. And now we see what that means. It means that the people in charge are willing to let you die en masse in order to make sure we don't change the system. They're willing to let so many people die in Canada, the country that during all of the Trump years, there was this smug pride because there's no way we could ever reach the barbarism of the United States. Look what happened. They had what happened on Capitol Hill. You know, we could never have anything bad here. And look back at what Ontario has been doing during the COVID pandemic and how many people died.
So many seniors died in the long-term care facilities. And now we were trying to steal vaccines from the allotment specifically for like poor and developing countries. And now we're a charity case for the U.S. All because, you know, 30 years ago, the Mulroney conservatives privatized Canada's domestic vaccine capacity and the liberals never brought it back under public ownership.
I didn't even know that.
So we'll get back on the talk of nationalization. Canada does not have the capacity to produce vaccinations in this country. And that's not the only reason, but one of the reasons we're up the creek without a paddle right now, because we used to have this infrastructure in Canada and it was privatized. And again, the liberals, the conservatives did it and the liberals never undid it. And so that's one of the reasons we are where we are. Neoliberalism, racism, hatred of the working class are killing Canadians to this day.
And on
nationalize everything.
Oh, go ahead. There we go. Sorry, say it again, Krista.
Nationalize
everything. Yeah. I think that is a good message to leave this on. You know, it's hard not to get discouraged when talking about these sort of things. But if you're feeling hurt and upset about this loss, chances are there's other people that are too. So don't believe that you're an individual when it comes to feeling beaten down by what this system will do to you. Because my belief is the system has to beat you down to maintain its authority. And you don't have to accept that. So please, you know, try to stay hopeful. The summer is coming. The seasons do end. If you haven't had a chance, please subscribe to the podcast. If you're just checking this out, at Left Turn Canada on Twitter, and send us an email, leftturncanada@gmail.com. We've gotten some really wonderful messages from a lot of people talking about, you know, how important it is to mobilize, and they love hearing someone talk about politics that isn't just, you know, completely neoliberal. So that really means a lot. And we've also gotten a few emails about how they can contribute to this program. So first of all, thank you so much for even, you know, considering giving any of your hard-earned money to us. You know, we do appreciate it, and we've been listening to what you've said. In the next few weeks, we believe April 1st, right, Christo, is the plan.
Yeah, not an April Fool's joke, but yeah, the basic plan is we talked about this we got some emails about it, and we put out a thing on Twitter. And, you know, there's two ways people find podcasts. One is like, you know, the Chapo Trap House way, where they do a couple episodes a week. One of them is free and one of them is for subscribers only, usually about $5 a month or what have you. What we felt, though, and a lot of people agreed, is that while there's nothing wrong with that model, the goal of this podcast in part is to get it out to as many people as possible. And you can't do that with a paywall. So we felt that we want to keep the main show, the main weekly show, you know, free for everyone to access. But to do that, we are going to need the support of people to help, you know, continue this work and cover our expenses and all those sorts of things. So what we will be launching is a Patreon, again, on April 1st. It will include all sorts of fun perks. For instance, you know, we'll if we ever do have ads on this show, if Amazon ever wants to advertise with us, then you will not have to hear those Amazon ads. If you you can have your name read out. If you give at a certain level, we'll have an infrastructure so people can maybe send in audio questions that we can answer live on the show. We're looking at longer term goals around streaming, maybe making this a video podcast. We have all these sorts of things. Andy has the idea of, at a certain support level, some really cool swag. Nothing confirmed yet, but Andy's really sold on some Canada, you know, Left Turn Canada socks. So yeah, so a lot of people are looking for ways to contribute. I know people have reached out to me individually, and we're hearing you. April 1st. It'll be a way you can support this podcast. The way you can support it right now, share it with your friends and family. Let them know that we're a cool show to listen to.
We're cool indeed, fellow kids. in case you didn't check it out, a couple of weeks ago, we talked to Nikki Ashton, NDPMP, about her upcoming event with Jeremy Corbyn. That has arrived. By the time you're listening to this, it's happening on Saturday at 3 o'clock, March 20th. We'll be sending out links, but if you Google either of them, you'll be able to get access. And there was a bit of controversy. I think it actually helped ultimately what the goal of this meeting was and this conversation was supposed to be. So I'm eager to check it out. Please make sure you do as well. Anything else, Krista? We had an idea and I think we'll probably push it to next week. But if you've listened this long, I'll leave you with that little tease here. We talked about politicians that have hurt this country, or at least I did. Talked about Doug Ford.
Yeah.
We want to open up to you. What is one of your most hated Canadian politicians? It's very easy to pick, you know, very famous American politicians, but I want to hear about the people I don't know about that have ruined your life locally, especially if they're under the guise of trying to help you. If these are real, like, neoliberal thought leaders that actually think that all homeless encampments need to be ripped up because they make the city look bad, but will wear, like, a kente cloth during the month of February. Like, someone like that. And that's John Tory. Just make sure that's the mayor of Toronto. So that's an example. If you have something like that, DM us. Like I said, at Left Turn Canada, or send us an email and we'll be going through some of them next week. Anything else to add, Christo?
Sounds good to me. Nope, good to go.
All right, have a good one. Thanks for listening to Left Turn Canada.
Thanks so much, everybody.